Okay, so going back to a conversation we had about 2 weeks ago about heroes, right? The heroic type from Western literature. And I was telling you that I was thinking about doing a blog post, and I potentially still will, about three different heroes that really shaped Western culture and Western civilization. The first of them being Achilles, the second being Odysseus, and the third is the much lesser known, but no less important, Aeneas, who was the one of the survivors of Troy's fall and founder of Rome. And he made a lot of sacrifices there. I think all of them had their virtues and things to talk about. But
Tell us about Achilles, because I mean, I think one of the best things you talked about is just the types of heroes that each of those, the different types of heroes that those three legends were to the Greek and Roman societies. So, I mean, starting off with Achilles, I mean, because understandably he seems to come first in the chronology of the Iliad, the Odyssey, and then the Roman Aeneid.
Right, absolutely. And what do people know about Achilles today? They know Brad Pitt from Troy. They know Achilles' heel, and they probably know something about his one weakness was his heel, and which is what killed him. Right, he had one weakness, and that was it. That was his downfall. But what they don't know about him was that he was the greatest warrior that ever lived, and even crafty, wily veterans such as Odysseus or Aeneas, who were, and Hercules even, heroes in their own right, never would have stood a chance against Achilles. So his whole story starts off with the recruitment to go fight in the Trojan Greek War, right? The Trojan War on behalf of Agamemnon. And for his recruitment, Agamemnon is assembling his team, not unlike his team of Avengers in today's modern superhero comic book lore.
Yeah, I think right? We're all familiar with the Avengers saga. They got 27 movies now.
Which is a whole other post, right? The American myth and our establishment of that. But he's getting together his team, and he's like, Achilles needs to be on this team. Clearly, he's just like Superman, right? He can't be killed. He's only got one weakness. Like, that's why Superman is he fails to inspire the American imagination, really. Because you watch a Superman movie, well, I already know what they're going to use to throw him off.
Yeah.
Kryptonite. That's it. Yeah. Like, how does Achilles die? His heel. That's it. And it's not that exciting, because he's not multifaceted in a lot of senses. But Agamemnon sends Odysseus, who we'll talk about later, to recruit Achilles. And, Odysseus weaves his tricks and his trails and all the things that he's known for. But what really sealed the deal for Achilles was his goddess mother came to him and said, you can stay here and not fight in this Trojan War. You will live a long and happy life and die surrounded by your children and your grandchildren and your wife and your family. But no one will ever know your name. Or you can go to certain death in the Trojan War and have eternal glory among the mortals. They will always know your name. They will always carry you in song and lore and history throughout your story. And he chose to go, which I think is very, very revealing about who Achilles was. That reveals his character in a lot of ways, because he has this secure, comfortable lifestyle ordained for him by the gods. It's not an unknown. It's a certainty. And he also has a certainty of death, but eternal glory. And he chooses eternal glory. So the Iliad, which is the greatest source material about Achilles, opens up with the gods are angry at the Greeks, and they send a prophet to find out what was going on and what was the cause of the gods' anger. And as a result, Agamemnon loses his trophy. Right, he loses the woman to appease the gods that he had rightfully won in combat. So he demands the field wife, the trophy of Achilles, to to be his, right? Which he violates the soldier's idea of what's right. He breaks the tribal rules and takes Achilles' wife to be his own. And because of that, Achilles felt so shamed, right? His pride was so hurt that he says, I don't care what happens to the Greeks now. Like, the Greeks will die in droves, and I won't care. I will sit by my ships, and me and my Myrmidons will not fight. We will sit right here, because you have violated our code. You violated our warrior code. And he refuses to fight. And, you know, Hector, who is an incredible character in his own right, and really merits his own discussion, just wreaks havoc among the Greeks and pushes them and starts burning their ships. And eventually, Achilles' cousin or brother or lover or whatever the historical interpretations say is so hurt by watching so many of his friends, so many of his fellow Greeks die, that he says, Achilles, let me go to battle. Let me go fight these guys. And he's like, okay, I can't really hold you back. I could, because I'm the most powerful man in the world, the most fearsome warrior that's ever lived and ever will live, and I can't hold you back, but I won't. I'll let you go free. In fact, here's my armor. Go out and fight as I would fight. And he really helps turn the tide for a long time, and then Hector sees him on the field of battle, mistakes him for Achilles because he walks like Achilles, he talks like Achilles, he fights like Achilles. He's like, if I kill Achilles, this war is over, because I beat the best of them. So he goes out there and he kills Patroclus, and then he realizes his mistake, and he knows that he has just written Troy's doom in stone on the wall. That's what he just essentially did by accident. And Achilles finds out about Patroclus' death, and he runs on top of a hill, and he yells, and he gives this almighty yelp. He gives this incredible shout that just drowns out all of the noise and chaos on the battlefield, and everybody knows instantly what happened, and who knows about it now. And there's an agreement between the Trojans and the Greeks, and they're both like, all right, hey, we both go back to our camps tonight, no more fighting for the rest of the day. Because the game done changed, as Biggie Smalls would say. Everything is different. Whatever we thought this warfare was, it's completely changed because now Achilles is going to fight. And he's so mad. He's so angry. And I think part of that is, part of the reason why Achilles is so angry is the same reason that drew him to the battle in the first place. It's his own pride. It's his own lust for glory. And the killing of his best friend was an affront to his mightiness. To think that you can challenge my friend, to mess with my friends is the same as messing with me. It's one of those things. And he realizes the pain of it, and he's like, how dare they think they can, and that anger to his pride supersedes what Agamemnon did to him, right? It's a greater affront to his pride. So he suits up, and he gets outfitted by the gods, right? His goddess mother goes down to Vulcan, and Vulcan makes him this incredible shield and this armor. And he goes out there and he just kills in droves. He kills so many people at one point that he drowns a river. He chokes a river with all of the bodies of the Trojans that he just leaves in his wake, and no one can stand before him. And he fights purely for glory. And that's everything you need to know about Achilles, right? And he knows he's going to die. And that's it. And of course, you know, he slaughters the Trojans en masse. Nobody can stand before him. No one comes even close to standing before him until Hector agrees to fight him in single combat. And Hector tries to make a very reasonable terms of agreement, a truce, if you will. Think about two fighters. We just watched Mayweather McGregor, where they're trying to come to terms in this fight. And think of Achilles as Mayweather. He's the guy with nothing to lose because he knows he can't lose. He knows he won't lose. He knows he's the greatest warrior that's ever lived and ever will live. And he knows he can beat Hector in single combat. And Hector's just worried about the burial rites. He's like, all I want is that I get returned honorably and as the gods dictate to my family, so I can assuage the grief of my father and my wife and my son. And Achilles says, there are no pacts between men and lions. Because that's what he saw himself as. He saw himself as a beast at this point, right? His pride had become this incredible, unreasoning beast that says, the lion doesn't care about what your burial rites say. I don't care what your gods say. I'm here to kill you, and that's it. I'm here to ravage the body. And that's what he does. He kills Hector in single combat, and then he ties him to his chariot and drags him around the city of Troy, you know, as the Trojans weep and as his wife stands by on the walls and watches her husband being dragged and mutilated as one would being dragged behind a chariot. And then he goes back to the tents of the Greeks, knowing that the war has completely changed because the only person that can stop the Greeks is now dead. And he denies the burial rites. He's like, Hector's going to stay out there and he's going to rot. That's what he's going to do. And then Priam, who is the king of Troy, in disguise, comes in through the Greek lines and reasons with Achilles and says, please, 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 give me what's left of my son. I know he's destroyed, his body's destroyed, and he's going to be mutilated in the underworld when he finally makes it there. But give me my son back so I can, as a father, have the burial rites and the closure that I need. And Achilles agrees to these terms. And that's how the Iliad ends, with the last sentence being, thus died Hector, tamer of horses. And that's it with Achilles. And
so I think it's interesting to look at how simple Achilles is in terms of a hero. If you compare him to the heroes that we have today, we like our heroes to be strong and brave and to be fighting for the right thing. But this was a very simple man when you look at him. He was the strongest and he was the most, you know, prideful. And that's not good. That's not good enough for us today. Although back in the days of the Greeks, Achilles was revered, you know, in same way. And it's interesting, as you were talking, I kind of drew the comparison with the people who spend a lot of their time going to the gym, but not for anything, you know, people who are bettering themselves, getting stronger, yes, or getting stronger maybe for the wrong reasons, or maybe so that they can look good in the mirror, or they can impress people, but for prideful reasons, you know? And I think that it was just a connection. It's not fully, I don't think I fully thought it through, but I do think it does ring of some comparisons to the idea of the Achilles archetype. But as you know, like, Achilles was a lot different than Odysseus.
Right.
Odysseus, who was with Achilles, who was a friend of Achilles, was much a different type of hero, and not in the same way that Achilles was prideful. Odysseus was slightly different, if you can talk more on that.
Yeah, and what characterizes Odysseus was his pragmatism, really. Yes, he was wily like a fox, it's the old saying that the fox knows many tricks, the hedgehog one good one, and Odysseus was absolutely the fox. He was so smart and so wily and so crafty, and that's what really characterizes him, is his ability to goddess born as well, or immortal born, his father, Telemachus was his son. I can't remember who his father was. It's been a while since I've read the Odyssey, and that's something that I'd like to dig back into. But Odysseus was not a man who could stand toe-to-toe with Achilles in single combat. And he never would. And him and Hector have one battle together in the Iliad, and they both fight, and they both walk away from each other saying, like, you know what? Odysseus says to Hector, you know, you're too strong, you're too good at combat for me to beat you. And Hector says, you are too crafty for me to beat you with my strength. You've got more facets to yourself and your personality that I can't outsmart you and beat you in that manner. And you're strong enough to hold me off while you're thinking about these things. So let's never meet again in battle. And they say, yep, good to go. And they walk away from each other. And that's it. that's the last battle between Odysseus and Hector, and that's so much different than the men don't make pacts with lions. And Odysseus is what I kind of see as like a modern hero, because he was such a pragmatist, right? What happens is, you know, in the long story, he's known as being a trickster, known as being wily, but he's the one that ends up coming up with the Trojan horse in the first place, right? To build this massive horse, and then leave in the middle of the night. All of the Greek fleet just sails away in the middle of the night, and all that's left is this gigantic horse. And the Trojans go out there and wonder, and like, hey, first off, where did the Greeks go? Second off, what is this? What is this beautifully built, incredible horse? And they end up deciding, through some trickery of the gods and Odysseus' own trickery, to bring that horse into their city. Meanwhile, Odysseus and his chosen followers are inside the belly of that horse. He was one of the guys inside it because he was that mighty of a warrior. Of course, in the middle of the night, they exit the horse, open the gates, get the Greeks sail around, and enter and rape the city of Troy. But what happens from there is Troy is taken, and Agamemnon, the king of the Greeks, is trying to decide who to award the greatest prize of valor. Is it Ajax or is it Odysseus? Because Ajax is only second to Achilles in his might. And he did a lot by, you know, it's like, hey, this guy is the second best guy they have. Send Ajax after him. This guy's the best they have. We need to hold him off for a little bit. Send Ajax, right, after Achilles was killed. And so he was the mightiest warrior. And if Ajax fought at Odysseus in hand-to-hand combat, Ajax would win. That's understood. But who's the more valuable, right? It's sort of like the annual MVP discussions in any professional sports league, right? One guy has more points and more rebounds or more touchdowns. But the other guy just means more because he's smarter and he's a general, right? He's Derek Jeter. He's the captain. He's the leader. And he's the guy who gets everything done. And that was Odysseus. And the prize ends up going to Odysseus. And then through various means of trickery and all that, Ajax rages against the gods, and his own hubris destroys him, right? His own pride, saying that I am Ajax. I destroyed Troy. Without the help of the gods, I can do anything. And then the gods kill him, strike him down, kill him and all of his men. Odysseus, on the other hand, never would do that because he knew how strong the gods were, and he would never stand against them. Instead, he angers the gods, and they send him on this roundabout quest, which is, you know, the Odyssey, this great quest that he has to fulfill. And as time goes on, through various trials and tribulations brought on by the gods, he ends up being the only one of his crew to reach the shores of Ithaca, his home shores, because he's so pragmatic about it. Yes, he loses them and he mourns them, but he's also moving on and thinking of his next trick. He's thinking of his next play. He's always thinking a couple steps ahead of everybody else and everything else, and that's what allows him to survive. He's just this wily fox that can't be defeated in a linear fashion. Because he's thinking three-dimensionally when everybody else is thinking X and Y axis. That's how Odysseus is. And then, of course, he returns home, and the gods cloak him to make him look weak and feeble. And he goes back to his own table and sees the suitors that are going for his wife, Penelope, and sits among them and endures their scorn and their mockery. And then, you know, the contest of the who can shoot through these axes, who's strong enough to draw this bow. And then Odysseus has this moment where he throws off the cloak and he stands up to his full height. And the gods give him the aura of the man that he is. And they reveal him to the suitors, and they're all dumbstruck with terror. And he draws back the bow and shoots through everything. And then, of course, the suitors are shaken in terror, and he slaughters all of them wholesale. And everyone in his household who was divisive and who worked against him. And that's another important part of the story, is that he not only destroyed the blatant, obvious characters, right? He destroyed the simple subversive people amongst his lower servants, right? Amongst the cooks, amongst the handmaidens, the ones that were trying to beguile Penelope. Because he discovered all that through his craftiness. And he's not a very moral character, right? He serves himself, and he serves his own selfish interests, right? Everything he does is to get home to Penelope, to include making love to a nymph on an island for a long time, to include
Calypso.
Yes, to yeah, exactly. Thank you. To include the death of all of his men under the guise of helping his people, right? To return to my people, I will let my people die, and that's all that Odysseus does, and it's really interesting how pragmatic he was to find the means. Really, in his case, the ends justify the means to 100% example.
Yeah, and just a complete, I guess, juxtaposition between Achilles and Odysseus. With Odysseus, I mean, obviously, Odysseus had a certain amount of strength, not comparable to Achilles.
Well, no one was, yeah.
Not comparable to Achilles, but he had some strength, but he also had the intellect and the, correct me if I'm wrong, was it Athena that was with him?
Yes.
It was one of the goddesses of wisdom that was with him.
Yep.
That kind of liked him, favored him because of his cunning.
Right.
Because of his cunningness.
Right.
And you think about, when I think of Odysseus, I think of Joseph Campbell's hero's journey. Just the cycle of what the hero actually, you know, goes through. Because you look at that epic, you know, adventure that he went on, you know, starting from the ordinary world of Troy, going to the island of Calypso, you know.
And many, many more stories in between.
Yeah,
that, yes.
Going, like,
yeah.
Outsmarting the Cyclops.
Yep.
Just so much, going into the underworld. There was a lot that he did, but it was just a huge juxtaposition between him and Achilles. So I think what we really come to now is that the final hero of Aeneas, who was at the Battle of Troy, and goes on his own journey. And for those of you who don't know, Aeneas is a little lesser known than Achilles and Odysseus, but Aeneas... the Romans wanting to have a story of their own, a mythos of their own, similar to what the Greeks had, wrote the Aeneid, which is the story of Aeneas, which allowed for Rome to trace their heritage and lineage back to the Battle of Troy. So, Adam, if you want to talk more on Aeneas.
Right. So, the Aeneid... which is the source material for the story of Aeneas, and he's a recurring character in the Iliad, and he has no role in the Odyssey, but he was commissioned, the poet Virgil was commissioned by Caesar Augustus, right? The adopted son of Julius Caesar, who, you know, had the battle with Mark Antony and won and decided the fate of Rome, and he said, look, we need our own Roman mythos. We need our own culture to go off of and unite us. So Virgil gets commissioned with the story of Aeneas, right? The Dardanians, the survivors of Troy, and how they left in sadness and established the Roman Empire, right? And so from Aeneas's line came Romulus and Remus. Of course, Romulus being the namesake of Rome itself. And the son of Aeneas is Illus, who becomes Julius Caesar, right? The first emperor of Rome. And the story is the story opens with the survivors of Troy on the waves, and they wash ashore in Carthage, and many of the Trojans that set sail with Aeneas are not there. They've got half of the fleet that set sail from Troy in Carthage, and Aeneas, knowing that his people are distraught, knowing that he has lost half of everybody they know, goes off and he scales a cliff by himself, and he hunts down a pack of, herd of deer, right? And he picks off enough deer to provide for the people, right? He brings down the choicest, biggest deer, and then he brings these deer back to the survivors of Troy and feeds his people. And I think that's very indicative of the person you're about to meet, because he has the strength and the bravery and the courage of his own to go off and climb a stormy cliff by himself. And then he had the prowess to locate the game and bring down the game and bring it to his people, right? So while they're all grieving for their lost comrades, he has this moment where everyone's like, they're like, Aeneas, what are we going to do? Like, we trust you forever because you are our leader and you have been ordained. And we know from experience that you are the guy to lead us. Like, what are we going to do? And it's really, really interesting how the Aeneid just breaks it down. And Aeneas, time and time again, swallows his own doubts, his own misgivings, and puts on a brave face for the sake of the Trojans, right? Hiding the grief in his own heart, he says, oh, I'm sure the rest of the Trojans, the rest of our fleet must have washed ashore someplace else. Don't you worry, we'll find them. And we will be, you know, we will bring the Trojan line. We will carry the fire. We will carry on the legacy of Troy. He comes to where Carthage is being constructed, and this also goes into the Roman legend by Dido was her name. She was a wrongfully deposed queen who falls in love with Aeneas, and she's asked to recount. She asked Aeneas to recount the story of the fall of Troy. And it's so powerful, legend has it, that when Virgil is reading the finished work, when he's reading the story to Caesar Augustus, that Caesar Augustus' wife had to leave the room in tears. She was crying because she was so emotionally distraught at the sack of Troy. Right? It's such a powerful scene and so well written. But you know, he tells the story like despite his own pain. And once again, he swallows his own pain to be able to tell the story, to recount his story. And him and Dido fall in love, and it turns out, you know, God appears to Aeneas in a vision and says, look, this is not where your people land. This is not where you stay. You need to leave these shores. And Aeneas, putting his own love, putting his own heart aside, looks at his people and says, okay, I need to do what's best for my people. And ends up leaving.
Yeah, I'll stop. I'll pause you there just because the idea of pietas and virtus, or virtus, however you want to translate that, is evident within Aeneas. But pietas being, you know, translated as duty, or Cicero defines it as which admonishes us to do our duty to our country or our parents or our other blood relations. And while Aeneas is carrying on that relationship with Dido, that sense of duty, that devotion to his country, to his future country that's not yet been made,
right,
or not yet been formed, drives him to actually pick up and leave Carthage. And because these two themes of pietas and virtus, virtus really being defined as, you know, the masculine virtue and masculine strengths, and, you know, really just that idea of being courageous, being brave, being strong, having those aspects of, you know, someone like Achilles, someone in a lesser respect like Ajax, or someone like Odysseus. But those ideas being at the forefront of Aeneas is powerful. And I think him leaving Dido is one of the most memorable depictions of that pietas and that virtus there.
Right. And what's important is the invocation of Aeneas' son, right? He looks down at Ilus and he's told by the gods that if he doesn't leave Carthage, then Ilus will never be a king, right? His son will never be a king. It says nothing about his own glory, He's not Achilles here. He's not doing his own glory. He's not Odysseus returning to his own kingdom where he will regain his right as the king of Ithaca. It's for the sake of his son, right? And that goes into, you know, the old, a society becomes great when old men plant trees whose shade they will never sit in. Then they will never live to sit in, right? That's Aeneas in a nutshell. And he ends up leaving Carthage, and as a result, Dido is heartbroken, and she kills herself by self-immolation to show her grief, and because of that...
But let's not forget, before she dies, she curses him.
Right.
She curses him with what will soon to be Hannibal, who will ravage Rome, and... basically adding to the mythos of the Roman legend, but right. Hannibal being seen as the arch nemesis of Rome.
Right.
And, you know, eventually defeated by, I think, Scipio Africanus.
Correct.
If I'm not mistaken. But that being played into the mythos of Rome.
Right.
Was her cursing a spirit upon Rome. And his future nation, which would come to be Hannibal.
Right, and I think what's important about that is to note that it fit the narrative that Caesar Augustus, I think he gave his guidance, he gave his lefts and rights to Virgil and says, hey, I want you to incorporate some of these things that's happened in our history and make it part of our mythos.
Yeah, I need you to take these things that have happened in this recorded time, and I want you to spice them up a little bit. And yeah. I want you to make them so that everyone believes in this common understanding of what our country is.
Correct. And what's so incredible about that was that because of that, you know, Hannibal invades Rome and, you know, through the north, through the Alps, and was a brilliant general, Hannibal Barca, and his father before him, Hamilcar Barca, both incredible fighters, but... That attack fails because the Romans sail on Carthage once again. And Scipio defeats Hannibal and then could potentially return to Rome and depose the Senate. Right? He has a chance to pull what Julius Caesar would later do long after him and be the returning conquering hero, the Douglas MacArthur, with the chance to depose the president. Right, he's got this upwelling of popular support. He can destroy the Republic. But he doesn't. He self-imposes exile upon himself. That's what Scipio does. Which is what we were just talking about with the Pietas. Right? It's the sense of duty and self. And Scipio chooses to exile himself and live a life of nothingness for the greater glory of the Republic of Rome. Which is incredible because he's embodying these traits of Aeneas before these traits were even written down. The Pietas was so central to the Roman ideal. So what happens is, carrying on with Aeneas' story, he leaves his heart in Carthage and sails and has these trials and tribulations. Eventually, finally lands in Italy and gets opposed by... by these tribes and the war, you know, he obviously forms alliances with some of them and some of them carry these convenient connections with the Trojan War and the Greek War, but the gods stir up certain enmity between them and some members of the tribes. And, you know, what happens from there is he gets into a...
I think it was Latium. The settle in Latium. And then King Latinus, who was there as well.
Yes. And Turnus. So he ends up making an alliance with them and getting promised to the daughter of King... sorry, say that again.
Latinus,
right. He gets his daughter gets promised to Aeneas, which angers Turnus, who is another tribal chieftain, and they fight against each other, and it's an incredible battle. And it, at one point, Jove dictates that the gods forsake Turnus. And this is an incredible battle. It's once again, it evokes the battle between Achilles and Hector. It's Aeneas versus Turnus. And then at one point, Turnus goes to lift this rock, and the gods forsake him at that time. And he goes to lift this rock, and he's got mortal strength, and he can't lift that rock. And he knows the jig is up, so to speak. He knows that he can no longer fight off Aeneas as he's been able to. And he turns to Aeneas, and he says, please, for the sake of the future of Italy, for the future of Rome, spare me for the sake of my father, and I will never fight you again. I'll ally with you, and we can build something together. And
Aeneas kills him. Aeneas kills him because he sees that Turnus is wearing the armor of Pallas,
right,
as a trophy.
Right. It evokes Hector and Achilles, because a favorite of Aeneas when he lands in Italy is the young prince Pallas. And so much so that he gives his own armor to Pallas to wear in a combat, right, to protect him. Just as Achilles gave that same armor to Patroclus and said, go out and fight in my name. And he falls, Pallas falls to Turnus, and Turnus strips him of his armor and fights Aeneas in this very same armor. And Aeneas thinks about it for a while, because Aeneas is a very good, reasonable man. He's so virtuous that he thinks about it, and he realizes for the sake of Rome, for the sake of his people, he's like, you know what, maybe we could build something from my strength plus Turnus's strength, right? Clearly I'm the top dog, I'm the alpha, but Turnus is also great in his own right, so maybe the alliance could be something we could benefit from. But then he looks down and he sees Turnus wearing the armor of Pallas, and he says, no, not while you wear the armor of Pallas. And he buries his sword in the throat of Turnus. And that's how the Aeneid ends. And that is the foundation of the Roman Empire, right? His own thoughts, his own cares are nothing for the sake of the empire, right? That's the primary good. Everything he does is for the patria, right? Non sibi sed patria, right? Not for self, but for country. That was Aeneas, 100%. That was the chief virtue of the Romans. And importantly, Rome was also built on blood. Right? The blood of Turnus that didn't necessarily have to be shed. That was the foundations on which Rome was built. And
so I think what's interesting is you take Achilles, you take Odysseus, and we just talked about Aeneas. And I'm probably oversimplifying here, but I think it is a helpful oversimplification in the sense that Achilles was motivated only by pride. He was the strongest, and he was the best. There was nothing more deeper to him. Odysseus, he was searching for home. He was trying to go back home to his wife, and he was cunning. He was strong as well, but in no way to the strength of Ajax or Achilles. But he was strong as well, but he was trying to make it back home. It was a personal thing for him.
Yep.
Aeneas is different in the sense that he is guided by those two virtues, virtus and pietas. He's guided by those virtues. It wasn't about him, it was about the future. It was about things he was not going to even experience. It wasn't going to be his glory. And he left his own personal... He could have stayed with Dido in Carthage and lived out the rest of his days there. But he kept going. And so you see kind of the... Having these three heroes side by side and seeing kind of the difference between them and taking it to a larger level. And I think we'll spend just a little bit of time on this, but taking this to a larger level in the sense that nations were formed by these documents. The Odyssey and the Iliad, like, Greece was guided by these documents.
Right.
Rome was guided by it.
But Alexander the Great stops his entire fleet, stops his entire army as they're about to cross over into Persia and invade Asia so that he can weep and pay his respects to the tomb of Achilles. Alexander the Great, right? Real historical figure. He stopped everything and said, I need to go see my predecessor, right? I am the transmutation of... I'm the rebirth, right? I'm the transcendence of Achilles. That's what he believed. That's the legend, the Greek legend that he conquered the world by. And it's that mythos. And it's, you know, the Roman virtues are very clear because of that story that was dictated to Virgil, who was incredible in his own right. And of course, Virgil was the guide for Dante in Dante's Inferno in the Seven Levels of Hell. It's the first person he meets is Virgil, who's Dante's guide, which is also an incredible thread throughout. There's a common thread throughout all of these things. And I think if we go into the American mythos, which I believe is these days being filled by comic book heroes, right? These the Marvel Universe or the DC Universe, of Avengers, of Superman, of Iron Man, of Batman.
I mean, I couldn't tell you offhand when Superman was created. I mean, but I'm assuming in the 40s or 50s. But that's part of the American mythos. And I mean, that's exactly what I was getting at, is every great nation has a mythos that they tell themselves. And right. I know I've written on this before, but it's important. These stories are important and these stories are powerful. You know, if you're sitting here today and saying like the Iliad, like it was something that was just written down on a piece of paper and, you know, it was a book, like, yes, empirically, in terms of your observation, yes, it was just a book. It was just a bunch of words.
Right.
But if you look at the power of those words, the actual power of those words and what they meant to the people and what they allowed for a nation to do, you may see it as something much larger than that. In the same sense, Rome. If right. Rome is able to trace their lineage back to Troy... Trace their lineage through Aeneas and back to Troy. I mean, anybody who's taken a history class knows the enormous impact that the Roman Empire had on the world today and Western society. Right. And looking at America and applying these things to America, we have our own heroes. We have our own mythos. And granted, it's not written in a single book that's mostly fiction, but we have real people that have been made, you know, almost tall tales. You know, people like George Washington.
Right, Paul Bunyan. Davy Crockett,
Daniel Boone. Like, these are people that did great things, and their legacy is probably exaggerated a bit.
Of course it is.
But does that exaggeration do harm to us, or does it do good for us? And that's what's interesting. I'm not asking people to dilute themselves.
Right.
I don't think you should dilute yourself about who George Washington was, because by all accounts he was a horrible general. But
tactically, yes. Tactically, sure.
By all accounts he was a horrible general. But there are certain things that you push the I believe button that really give you some faith and are part of the American mythos and part of that collective story that a country has. You know, Rome had Horatius, they had Aeneas, Greece had Achilles, they had people like Ajax, they had Heracles or Hercules, they had Odysseus.
They had Jason, right?
They had Jason of the Argonauts for the right. quest for the Golden Fleece.
Right, right.
And we have our heroes, and I think that's really one of the most powerful things is the mythos that great countries have to bring them to greatness, and what happens when we quit believing in those things.
Right, when we start pointing out the historical anomalies in these things. And I think that if we were to talk of those three heroes in terms of today, right, because superhero movies are all the rage right now, they make billions of dollars in the box office, and in turn, hundreds of millions of dollars are spent for Guardians of the Galaxy, right? The Avengers Assemble, all kinds of, you know, the Justice League,
Captain America,
whatever. One,
Captain
two,
America
three, four,
fights
five, six.
Iron Man.
Exactly, all kinds of stuff happens with that. And I think that, like, to break down these these heroes, Superman is Achilles. He has all the strength in the world. He's undefeated, unbeatable, but he's got one weakness. It's his ankle, or it's kryptonite. That's it. He's not that exciting. He's motivated by one thing, and with Superman, I don't know that well enough to know what his thing is, and it's pretty naive to think about it, but Achilles was all glory.
Justice and goodness.
Truth, justice, the American way.
Yes.
Right, to fit whatever narrative. We needed him to fit. Right, to fit the narrative the American people needed him to fit at the time. And I think that Odysseus is like, he's Loki in the Avengers, right? He's everybody's favorite villain. He is this pragmatic guy that has, sometimes he's a good guy, sometimes he's a bad guy. Sometimes he makes these mistakes, but he's so tricky and he's so clever that he's able to think his way out of these mistakes. And we end up rooting for this guy, right? Nobody hates Loki. He's not the the Joffrey Baratheon, right? He's not the hated character that everybody agrees, like, yes, I hate that guy so much. Loki's a pretty likable guy. And you see the trailer for the new Thor Ragnarok. You know, like, oh yeah, Loki's definitely on fighting on the side of Thor and Hulk, and that makes sense to me, right? That's Odysseus. He's so able to transmutate between all these different characters to fit whatever needs he needs to fit to get his ultimate goal accomplished. Aeneas is this cliche early Captain America as created by the government during World War II, right? Captain America punches out Hitler. Right, Captain America defeats this Nazi organization back in the early 1940s or the mid 1940s. He is non sibi sed patri, in human form, not for self but for country. That's what he is, and not as dynamic, not as exciting, not as sexy as an Odysseus, but no less important. Right, and once we point out all its cliche about him, we lose all of his virtues. We lose the fact that he was so willing to self-sacrifice, and everything he did was for the sake of his son, for his people. And to point out the cliche, to point out the fact that this guy's kind of naive about some stuff, is to completely miss the point whatsoever, and to degrade everything that he ever did and all the sacrifice that he made. And I think that's incredibly important.
Yeah, so I think with that, I think we've covered, you know, Odysseus, Achilles, Aeneas, and just what those things mean today. And I think if you don't have anything else, I don't have anything else. I think that's all we got.
That's it.